What's up, everybody? Welcome to Culture Binge, Wisecrack's culture podcast. This is our second attempt. This is the Culture Binge for May 22nd, 2019. And this is another experiment for us. We tried this about 2 weeks ago, and we got some really great feedback. And so we're going to be trying it again. So let me introduce the people who are going to be with me today. Today we have Alec.
Hello, hello.
Alec runs content with me at Wisecrack. And introducing, this is somebody who's been working with Wisecrack for a long time, but never been on our podcast, we have Serby. How's it going, Serby?
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. So Serby has worked with me on Thug Notes. She does a lot of the research for some of our videos, and we're really glad to have her.
I'm so excited to be here.
Cool. So up top, minor announcement. First thing we want to get to is The Big Bang Theory has ended on May 16th. The last episode aired. And, you know, it's kind of a wisecrack thing to shit on The Big Bang Theory. So we're all glad to kind of have this out of the zeitgeist.
Yeah, hopefully it'll stay dead. Also, I guess fans are mad at the finale, which will be relevant for our next conversation.
Yes. But anyway, so I want to go through the topics that we're going to be covering today. So first, we're going to be talking about the Game of Thrones finale, which, of course, every publication known to man has talked about. We're going to be talking about a new thing that Amazon is doing in gamifying the labor that the people do at the fulfillment centers. We're going to be talking about a particular court case with a sex cult called Nexium. We're also going to be talking about the porn law that's going into effect in the UK in July. We're also going to be talking about the Old Town Road song by Little Nas or Little Nas X. I have no idea if he has anything to do with the other Nas.
It doesn't.
Serby also has something to update on the Marie Kondo craze. We're also going to be, if we have time, talking a little bit about platform gaming and a new advancement in vaping technology by Juul that may or may not be pushing us closer to a dystopia. So I'm going to start things off with talking about Game of Thrones. So as I'm sure you're all aware, Game of Thrones has ended. People are largely unhappy with the ending, and a petition to redo the whole season has reached over a million signatures.
I think it's at 1.5 million now.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
So I want to hear from you guys. Did you guys watch the finale? How do you guys feel about it?
Serby, have you seen it?
I have seen it. And are we allowed to talk about like what happened, or is this
spoiler-free? Oh, yes. Okay. Spoilers ahead.
I saw it. I thought it was disappointing, and I thought it was a really, like, I think the last few episodes were just really bad storytelling. And although I'm disappointed with the direction that the creators took, I think I'm more baffled by HBO allowing the creators to get away with this. It just, to me, it illustrates a lack of integrity and commitment to one's quality of work. And if I were a network trying to figure out whether to give them a global deal, I would be wary because they've exhibited such little care when wrapping things up.
And you're talking about HBO offered, they're like, oh, you can do 10 episodes, and they chose to do 6, right?
Yeah, and then, or just being more involved in terms of, like, the story. Like, how, I mean, I understand they wanted to tie things up very neatly, but to me it feels like they had, like, 5 storylines that they wanted to make sure they got done, and it was more important to them to just tie the knot rather than show some, like, detail or, like, make people earn what happened to them. It was just like, oh, we want Arya to go explore. We want Daenerys to die. We want Jon to go frolic with the free folk. And it felt like they were just ready to be done, and they were done.
Yeah, I often, when people get very upset at show creators, I sort of scoff a little bit. But this finale honestly put me in a bad mood. I woke up in the middle
really
of the night.
Mood.
I wouldn't call them nightmares, but nightmare-esque. Like my girlfriend said, I was talking in my sleep about Game of Thrones. And then the whole next day I was in a terrible, this never happens to me, by the way. Game of Thrones is not part of my identity. I watched the whole show. I really enjoyed it, but it's not like I've read all the books and have, you know, fucking Daenerys posters on my wall. But even still, I was in a bad mood the entire day, and Jared can attest to this. And then when we were talking about making a Game of Thrones episode, it was just putting me in a worse episode. I was being mentally tortured by just constantly hashing over. And the more I would talk about it, the more I realized, like, wait, this doesn't make sense. Like, what's the deal with the Three-Eyed Raven? was this all part of Bran's plan? Nothing makes sense. And then, of course, just the pacing of it all, right? Like, even if in the books Daenerys ends up dead and Jon ends up in the Free Folk, that's not necessarily bad. It's just that the pacing was such that it just felt very kind of paint by numbers. Like, Daenerys says she wants to be feared. Now she's burning people alive. Now Jon has stabbed her. Now he gets exiled. And rather than like the regular pace of Game of Thrones, which is like, I'm going to write 2,000 pages to, you know, go over these very detailed character arcs. Yeah, but Jared, I feel like you did not hate it as much as me.
Well, it's very bizarre because in general, when it comes to media related things, I tend to care more than you do. And I can't even really think of a, you know, we've gone through some, you know, some taxing times with the company at Wisecrack. And Alec has always been pretty even keeled. He's been like a Buddhist monk. And yet, for some reason, Game of Thrones really was, I think, the only thing I can think of that put you in a decidedly sour mood. I actually, like, I want to ask why. Like, I know that you didn't like it, but I'm just really surprised that it got to you.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, you know, there's been shows where I've been disappointed by the finale. Like, I think at the time, The Office is a show that I love. And the finale is like, eh, whatever. Or even like the second season of Westworld, I didn't like. But at no point am I ever like, how dare they? And even this, I'm actually very against people. I want to be wary of like calling out D&D, as they're called. I forget their actual. I know it's like Dave Benioff and some other. I don't want to be like, how dare you? Because like, I think lots of good writers have done shitty things. Like, you know, James Gunn did a great job with Guardians of the Galaxy. He also made a terrible Scooby-Doo movie. But I'm not like, how dare you? James Gunn ruined Scooby-Doo. This is years and years ago. So if I ever saw them in person, I wouldn't be like, how dare you? I'd be like, oh, you wrote a cool show and then I didn't like the ending. Well, whatever. Like, you're just trying to do your best, allegedly. But yeah, I don't think that's productive. But as far as like why it put me in bad news, I don't know. It's like I spent 70 hours with these characters. Or something like that. And then you always have that sort of empty feeling after show ends. But I think the amount of time and also, yeah, just like the quickness to which it wrapped up and the seeming arbitrariness had me really in a terrible mood. I don't know what to say. Maybe it's also that I didn't get sleep because of the nightmares and that compounded things.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I guess I had already been thinking all this time that there's no way this is going to please people. There's no way that people are going to be happy with it. So I wasn't really that pissed off about it. Honestly, it was kind of better than I feared it would be. But that's not, I don't really want to talk about the specifics of what they did, what they didn't. I mean, there's plenty. I mean, there's at least 7,000 other podcasts that will tell you that Daenerys wasn't properly developed or that she had her turn too quickly or whatever, whatever. And all those are valid criticisms. But I really want to ask you guys, can serialized television end well? My thesis is that it almost always will end in failure. And I've done a little bit of research and I've read some articles recently that I think really highlight this point. So I'll contend that the reason that that shows like Game of Thrones or Lost or The Sopranos are successful is because they suspend catharsis indefinitely. So what I mean by that is most, you know, endings per se, you think of a movie or you think of a book, you think of a self-containing thing. When it ends, it gives you that moment of catharsis. Whereas with a television show, especially a serialized television show, that thing is always pushed away. And so I actually read this article in Wired by an author named J. David Bolter, and he argues that the aesthetic of video games has flown into all of culture. And I think the way that he describes the way that we consume media today is a really interesting way to consider what it's like to watch a serialized show like Game of Thrones that people are so passionate about. So he talks about this concept called flow. And what flow is, it's a term that was coined by a psychologist. He's some sort of Eastern European, and I am not going to be able to pronounce his name because it's something like Mihaly
Csikszentmihalyi.
Damn. Holy shit. How do you know that?
I read a lot of his works in business school.
Oh, okay. Wow. All right. Maybe you should be talking about
this, Serby, though. What do you know about flow? You're probably the expert on this.
No, no, I don't want to steal a spotlight from Jared.
Well, you can correct me if I get anything wrong, but he basically says that our media today, it offers such a variety of passive experiences that basically are characterized by flow, and flow is essentially the pleasure of losing oneself. And the seduction that a serialized television show, what it does to us is it's not only pleasure in the moment, but it's also the seductive possibility that this moment might go on indefinitely. And while he's talking about this in the context of video games, like especially if you're playing a video game that is without a narrative, like you're playing Fortnite or you're suspended in this state of pleasure that could just continue going and going and going. And I'd argue that this is especially true for binge watching. And there was another article that I read by a guy named Richard J. Allen, and he is a screenwriter and a philosopher, and he has this article that's in the Journal of Film and Video called Beginning, Middle, and End of an Era: Has Technology Trumped Aristotle? And what he's essentially saying is that, so Aristotle or Aristotelian principles of storytelling are about having a beginning, middle, and an end, and there's a shift from good to bad, or from bad to good, and that there's a cathartic ending. You follow a character that goes through some sort of change that culminates in some sort of meaningful payoff. But he claims that that's no longer something that we require in our entertainment. He says, and this is a quote, "A consumer with even a modest arsenal of technology can tap into a feature film, television episode, YouTube clip, or video game anywhere, anytime. Armed with this equipment, being an audience member is no longer about a temporary state defined by the moments one spends in a theater or in home watching a given television program. Instead, the moments between viewing become mere pauses that occur during an ongoing, lifelong viewing experience that can be tapped into at any time, literally at the push of a button or the tap of a screen." And what this leads to is that viewers don't need to watch something from beginning to end because it's always available. So why labor to create a neatly structured story that builds to predictable conclusions? Instead, these days, the optimal stories for new media focuses on an extended middle in which infinite scenarios and interactions just continue to play out. And so the point here is that when you have a show like Game of Thrones that's seasons 1 through 5, which everyone claims is perfect, maybe they think that parts of it are imperfect, I would contend that that is a show that is not building towards an ending. It is not built it's not built for something that will end with catharsis. And once you impose that on it, it becomes a different show. So, yeah, you can create seasons 1 through 5 and, you know, continue to just, like, push away moments of catharsis and continue to introduce new conflicts and that never really need to resolve anywhere. But once you impose the necessity of bringing these things to a conclusion, of giving the audience that catharsis, I mean, that's like literally like building a bridge and then halfway through realizing that you need to build a different kind of bridge that holds a different kind of weight. It's just not going to work. And just think about any television show. How often are there serialized television shows in which people like the ending? One of the people in our Discord sent us a graph on Tableau Public. I actually don't know what this is, but it's a graph of the IMDb scores for all these serialized shows once they end. Game of Thrones, Dexter, House of Cards, True Blood, Pretty Little Liars, 2 and a Half Men, Girls, and How I Met Your Mother all tank at the end. Now, this can't just be that all of these writers are incompetent. I mean, these are the highest paid writers in Hollywood for these shows. It can't be that all of them are just dumb and they should be listening to people on Reddit. It can't be that. I really do think that when you're creating a successful TV show, you are writing for a certain kind of viewing experience, one that is more akin to flow and less to catharsis. And then once you have to shift your priorities to finding some sort of conclusion, and all conclusion still does function on, you know, the promise of a cathartic ending, shit will start to fall apart. So that's my spiel.
So I think it's interesting in the charts. So all those shows tanked at the end, except the shows that are episodic. So Parks and Rec and The Office, and I think there was one other one. They stay pretty consistent. They might go down a little bit, but it's almost like when it's episodic, like The Office, there is an overarching plot barely of, you know, Jim and Pam get together and they have kids, and then he's got a job thing that he's going to. But overall, and by the way, this is a show that I watch regularly as I go to sleep every night. Like, I've seen the whole thing like 8 times. It doesn't really feel like it's building to anything. If anything, it's, I think, the perfect encapsulation of this flow idea, because I just watch it as a thing to not necessarily pass time, but just to sort of be in the moment. Like, I laugh a little bit and I can really turn on any episode from any season and just go back into it. It's not like if I tuned into Game of Thrones, I would have to like remember exactly where I am in the plot. The way I've always heard flow, and Serby, I want to hear what, because you've actually read all this stuff, but I always heard in terms of sports where it's like, if you're pitching or let's say you're an archer and you're trying to like hit the target, if you're thinking about like, where's my arm positioned and all this stuff, you're probably going to mess up, and flow is the state in which your body motions essentially become automated. And this is like a thing for most like very practiced athletes. And that is like the ideal state to be in. And it's weird. So for video games, I think that's interesting because, I mean, there's so many video games I play and I'm like, holy shit, it's 6 hours later. Like SimCity is a good example. Like, there is no really end to SimCity. I just want it to kind of go on forever. And then when I build everything, I get sad. But not as sad as I was in Game of Thrones. But yeah, I think, I don't know, like I really like this argument. I think people want to watch Game of Thrones because they want little, there's like little catharses, right? When a certain battle is won or a person dies or wins or something like that. But overall, it's like, we want to see these seeds planted in the plot, and we want to see them grow, but we don't necessarily want to see them all tied up at the same time. What do you think, Serby?
So when I studied flow, it was more in terms of work. So when you mentioned that you would play SimCity and like 6 or 8 hours would go by, that's how we thought about flow, is in the moment when you're working and when you're done, you're completely drained and exhausted. That's how we thought of flow. And I think it's interesting that like flow is being used to like apply to a viewing experience, because that's not something I would have thought of. And I wonder if, like, I agree that I like the middle, like I like the journey and I like the tension. And when it comes toward to like wrapping things up, is the answer then hiring like a screenwriter, like for films, to come in and wrap things up, like someone who's more experienced with tying up loose ends in a finite amount of time? Like, is it just a different skill set?
I don't know. I mean, I think that even if you hired the best screenwriter in the world, he still has to deal with the fact that, you know, he's basically, the writers of seasons 1 through 5 give him a lump of clay to mold. And I just don't think, you know, he's not starting from scratch. I don't think that that lump of clay is really building towards, it's not something that is conducive to that screenwriter's skill set. I just think it's kind of like the thing I said with Abridged, like seasons 1 through 5 were not building towards, they weren't built to lead to a cathartic conclusion, but that's ultimately what they were required to do. And I just don't think that was ever really going to end well. And it's also worth noting that those other shows that you mentioned that are on this graph, so The Office, Parks and Rec, and The Big Bang Theory, are 3 shows that do end on an up, that when the show ends, it's actually as loved or loved even more than it usually is. And those are all episodic shows. Just like you said, you can tune in at any episode and you can get it. Now, granted, they do have some sort of finality, but the previous, you know, decade or whatever of episodes aren't at least pretending to lead to some sort of a conclusion. When you watch episode 1 of The Office or episode 50 of The Office, you're not asking the same question of like, will Michael Scott retire? Yeah. Whereas with Game of Thrones, the question is always, who will be on the Iron Throne, or who will bring Westeros to peace, or whatever. But in reality, that's, I mean, obviously because the books weren't done, they weren't actually building to that conclusion.
George R. R. Martin allegedly told them how he's going to end the books, or at least how characters ended up. The question is, did they follow that advice? I think the books could satisfyingly have the same conclusion if they just got there in a way that wasn't condensed into like 6 episodes of TV. And they won't, because I'm sure he'll write like thousands of pages of books or just die beforehand, which is why I refuse to start the books until they're all done. But yeah, I wonder I wonder how many Game of Thrones fans are just terrified George R. R. Martin will drop dead of a heart attack.
Most of the Thrones fans that I talk to have just given up hope. They're like, yeah, it's not going to finish.
Oh, that's why I won't. That's why I'm not going to read them.
Yeah.
I wish that I believed in something as passionately as these fans who are signing this petition and are so passionate about having this last season remade.
No.
Like, I can't think of anything in my life where I would be that riled up about.
But you don't wish that, because think of how devastated these people are. Like, you don't want to put your mental health in the hands of a bunch of TV writers who chances are don't really care about this ending and want to just go make their new Star Wars trilogy. Like, you don't want to do that.
But I wonder, like, how could I channel that kind of passion? Like, it's fascinating to me. Like, if they channeled it into something more productive, like, what could they do?
You know,
yeah, I don't know. I mean, I used to be one of these people when it came to, like, The Matrix was so tied to my identity, and I talk about this a lot. But, yeah, when The Matrix, especially the third one, came out, like, I was devastated, like, devastated. And it's not something I'm proud of. Like, it's embarrassing, but it's just not a good. It's just not a good thing. But I'll say that it's not a positive energy. At least it wasn't for me. It was more that there were other things in my life that were really making me unhappy. So I just decided to invest my energy in something that I thought I could trust, something that would kind of, like, quote, always be meaningful for me. But it, you know, it's like anything else. It's going to disappoint.
I kind of agree with Serby. I always have this thought, and I think it's a double-edged sword. On one end, you have people who are so upset at Sonic that they'll, like, rip apart a GameStop, and I don't want to be that person. But, like, there's this guy who cries at Star Wars trailers, and I'm like, I wish I could care about anything as much as he cares about Star Wars. Like, you could tell me the best news in the world, and I'd be happy, but I feel like I'd never reach that level of, like, pure ecstasy that this guy is from watching a fucking trailer.
I feel that way. Like, there are a couple of, like, obsessions I have in my life, and, like, one of them is Harry Potter, and the other one is, like, European Christmas markets. And whenever I engage with, like, either one of my obsessions, I do become, like, overwhelmed emotionally and a bit unstable, actually. So I don't know. Like, I guess that would be the only time in my life where I could identify with this Star Wars weeper.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. We should move on to the next thing, because we've already talked a lot about Game of Thrones.
All right, so the next one is from an article I read in Gizmodo. The headline is, Amazon goes full Black Mirror by turning grueling warehouse work into a video game. This is an article by Katie Keck. So this is a quote from the article. Amazon is currently experimenting with a pilot program that turns warehouse jobs into a sort of video game, a system the company claims is meant to break up the monotony of the day-to-day tasks required of its workers, but has conveniently led to competition among employees to outperform their colleagues, according to reports. Names of these games include Mission Racer, Pix in Space, Castle Crafter, and Dragon Duel. That's according to the Washington Post. And these games reward workers with points, virtual badges, and other goodies throughout a shift. In at least one warehouse, rewards also include an internal currency called Swag Bucks, which can be exchanged.
Swag bucks?
Swag bucks.
Okay.
Which can be exchanged for Amazon branded gear, according to the Post. That's like that South Park episode, right? This is almost like an Onion article, but I swear to God it's not.
Well, yeah, it should be real money that they're giving them for overperforming in their job.
Right, but they're not going to do that.
No.
I don't understand, like, this, like, need to, like, gamify everything. And, like, to I went to this conference recently, and one of the things that they were discussing is, let's gamify human interaction. So how many people did you interact with today? How many people did you meet? And, like, what the fuck? Like, why do we need to gamify? Why do we need to dehumanize human interaction? I don't want to, like, do something really great with my job and my reward is a goddamn Amazon hat. Like, why don't you give me the $5 that you spent on that hat instead?
Okay, I definitely think we shouldn't gamify human interaction, because I think we can agree that there is some sanctity to human interaction. It's sacred. It shouldn't be gamified. It shouldn't be some sort of end of it in itself. Like, we should be interacting with people because we like people, not because we're trying to get a cool hat or something like that, or just to get extra points. But with labor, especially if your job is not fulfilling labor, I don't know. I don't really have a problem with this. There are plenty of people who, you know, have jobs that are basically just only a couple of degrees separated from assembly line work. And if that's your job and the gaming makes the time go by faster or easier or makes it more engaging, I'm having a hard time thinking of why that's a negative.
Well, yeah, I think there is a point to that. But on the other end, it's about efficiency. And it's I mean, the reason people want to gamify everything is for efficiency's sake. If you're playing a video game, the gamification is often for you to like spend more money. In this sense, it is for people. I think they're the people who sort the packages or sort the objects that go into the packages, whatever it is. But yeah, I mean, on one end, sure, you can make it more fun. And there's lots of office culture-y things that do this. But it breaks up the monotony, sure. But at the end of the day, it's like, you're going to increase your output by 10 or 15%, but we're not going to pay you more. We're going to give you like a t-shirt. And like, I'm very critical of that because it's like, pay them more. That being said, if Wisecrack, if they're like, hey, Alec, if you do X, Y, and Z, we'll send you like, I love food. If they send you some fucking cupcake or something, I'd be like, oh, hell yeah. And I would be really motivated, but it would definitely be a little manipulative.
Well, look, I feel if their output is increased and the job is more fulfilling, then that seems like a win-win to me. Now, should they also pay them more if their output is increased? Yes. But I also think that their output will be increased even more if instead of an Amazon hat, it was something that they actually wanted.
Right.
So if it was a cupcake, then it would be even more of a win for both parties.
I think this is bad for company culture. I think it cultivates competition and it serves as a way for executives to identify low performers, which is obviously good for a business. But I think it's done in a way that's dishonest. Like, oh, this is for your benefit. Like, we're doing this so that you have more fun doing your routine tasks.
Does everyone have to do this or do you opt in?
I think you opt in. But to Serby's point, it's like, I don't know if you've seen Office Space Serby, but where it's, so they have to wear these pins at this like TGI Fridays-esque restaurant. What do they call them, Jared?
Pieces of flair.
Yeah, pieces of flair. And the pieces of flair are meant to like express your personality. But the whole framing is like, don't you want to have fun and express your fun personality? It's like, and the whole thing is Jennifer Aniston's character doesn't have enough flair. I was like, oh, I thought the minimum is 20. And it's like, well, if you just want to do the bare minimum, that's up to you. But our other team members like to express themselves even more and wear 30 pieces of flair. And this is like, yeah, to your point, Serby, I think it's just like a dressed up version of that. And yeah, I think competition wise, like in a company where you're just like shuffling packages across, I haven't worked in an Amazon factory, Amazon warehouse, but I imagine it's not that collaborative. I guess like the competition could just be fun, but also could be very Orwellian if like people are getting fired for not playing this game correctly. If it were a more collaborative environment like Wisecrack, I think, you know, to your point, this idea of competition can often be very corrosive. I love working for Wisecrack because like, I'm not like, oh yeah, I had a better idea than Jared today. Like I win. And I don't think Jared thinks that either. Or I don't think, you know, maybe I don't know you that well, but I don't think you do that. But I think like, if we did think that, that would be very bad for the company.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Let's move on. What's next? Serby, what do you got for us?
So I'd like to talk about this article that I read in the New York Times. Life as a Nexium Slave, Branding, Whippings, and Cold Showers. It's by Colin Moynihan, and it's about a sex cult called Nexium. It started off as a multi-level marketing scheme, and now we have young women being beaten, tortured, forced into sex slavery, and they have their master's initials branded onto their bodies. Currently, the former leader of the cult is on trial, and the information coming out of the courtroom is just horrific. And what was striking to me is that it's like Scientology if it were created in Nocturne Alley. So they have like all these levels of like participation, and the first stage is the leaders would require the recruits to divulge sensitive, embarrassing information that could then be used for blackmail purposes. And eventually they would sign away all of their property and money. And I'm having a hard time understanding, like, I understand like cults are all about brainwashing and they're all about like preying on individuals who are maybe undergoing like a crisis situation. But I don't understand how the first stage is let's divulge personal information. I will straight up lie to people if they ask me what my name is or like what color is your hair. I would be like, it's blonde. I can't imagine like that would be the first step, and people are okay with that, and people are okay with getting branded.
Well, they're doing well at the multi-level marketing, and they're like, hey, you're our star person. Do you want to do this leadership retreat where you like tell your personal, because I think that not the blackmail part maybe exists in a lot of like kind of like self-helpy things, is like, tell us your inner dark secrets and we'll break you down and build you up again. I feel like that's most like business. I mean, it seems like you have a business background that you could speak more to that, but is that what happened?
Yeah, it is like, so I mean, it's not as if they just like met some random girl off the street and they're like, oh, hey, tell me about that time you did porn when you were 14. Right. It's more like, oh, like, let's discuss like your problems. And then it like slowly builds from there. But I don't know. Like, this whole sex cult is, I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around it.
What was the product that the multi-level marketing scheme was selling? Do you know?
It was like executive, like it was basically like a business sort of thing, like executive skills and like leadership stuff. I can't remember exactly, but the idea was like all of these like well-known executives like Richard Branson, and there was like a former Surgeon General and a former Enron executive would sign up, and you would just learn how to be a better leader, a stronger leader.
Oh, man. Have you guys ever had any run-ins with cults or people that you know?
Have you?
I have not personally, but I had an ex-girlfriend, and while I was with her, one of her close friends who I knew went on this retreat that sounded a lot to me like a cult. And when he came back, he had a totally new outlook on life, and he had and he wouldn't even hang out with us anymore because he could only hang out with that group of friends.
Oh.
And he was in a relationship with one of the girls, and they were, you know, approaching seriousness at light speed. And then she was telling me that she wanted to go, and I was like, I don't know. She didn't end up going. It ended up being for totally different reasons, like for health reasons she didn't end up going. But I never saw that guy again. I only saw stuff that was going on social media. But I think like this kind of stuff was, so wait, was this in New York or was it in California?
I think it was all over, but I think it was in California as well, because there were quite a few celebrities involved, or actors. I don't know if we would call them celebrities.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the business thing. I feel like the line gets very blurred because in California, there's all sorts of alternative mentorship, alternative health practices, alternative gurus, all this stuff. And I feel like a lot of people go to these things seeking mental health or even just like exercise or something like that. Just alternate ways to feel better about themselves, to have a new path in life. And well, maybe a new path in life is a little bit strong, but people are just looking for alternative ways to grow and to help themselves, and very quickly it becomes a cult. And yeah, I don't know, but honestly, none of these things really surprise me. I'm never surprised to hear about cults. I just kind of get it, especially in California. I mean,
especially in California.
Yeah, especially in California. When people join the Church of Scientology, I'm like, I get it, man. You know, didn't you
know somebody who like went to the Scientology Center in LA?
You're asking if I know somebody?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Did you talk about this?
I had a friend who was working. So this woman had a marketing company, and he was working for her remotely in Texas. And she lived in Los Angeles, and he was coming to Los Angeles just to see if he wanted to move there. But he figured, you know what, I might as well visit and see my boss person to person. And I think she had mentioned it once before, but he didn't really know. But apparently she was a Scientologist, and she said, hey, why don't you meet me at the Scientology Celebrity Center? And so he was like, okay, whatever. So he met her at the Scientology Celebrity Center, and she was like, oh, hey, the guy's name's Andy. He's like, Andy, so good to see you. Great, great, great. You know what? Just hold on 1 second. And so they're in this room. She leaves him from the room, closes the door, and he's just chilling in this room for a bit. And then three other people enter the room.
Oh, no.
And make him watch a video.
Oh, no.
And then he's like, you know, I don't really want to watch this video. I'm like, oh, no, it's a really great video. It's only going to be 30 minutes. He ended up being there for 2 hours of him basically having to watch Scientology videos. And he said, like, eventually when he actually got up and started getting physical, when I say starting getting physical, no one was actually trying to physically restrain him, but he's, because at one point it was a little bit blurry about, like, oh, do these people also work for my boss? If I'm rude to these people, will I get fired? When he realized that they just worked for the church and had nothing to do with this lady, he basically just plowed through them and left. But either way, super shady thing to do.
You know,
I mean, at least his boss's initials weren't branded onto his hip.
Well, not yet. I mean, he if he had stayed, maybe. But yeah, that's...
The Nexium thing, and I don't want to downplay how fucking horrible it is, because it's very horrible. But I'm struck by... Okay, so there's this thing I've been obsessed with since I found out about it, which is email scammers will intentionally put typos in, and I've mentioned this to you, Jared. They'll put typos in their emails because if you can spot the typos and be like, this doesn't seem legit, you already have too much critical thinking skills to be like in their sales funnel, kind of, right? So it's a way to like make their time more efficient, right? Like the people who respond to this typo written email saying I'm a prince who needs like $1,000 are the people I want. And so I think a lot about that, like, sort of funnel logic. And to me, like, starting with a multi-level marketing scheme is brilliant, because the people who'd get involved into a multi-level marketing scheme already are the people that you could convince to join a sex slave cult. And I'm not, I mean, I feel very bad for these people. I don't want it to happen there, but I do think it's very interesting.
What is it about multi-level marketing and sex cults?
Because, I mean, listen, like, I feel like cults prey on people who are going through shit, who, like, have their
They're
own
vulnerable.
Unresolved traumas or whatever, who maybe, you know, aren't, you know, there's a lot of different things that I'm sure they try to hook into. And I feel like people who are desperate enough to fall for a multi-level marketing scheme would fall for a lot of other things. I don't know. You can disagree with that.
They're already, like, at baseline quite vulnerable.
Yes. Yeah.
So it's like they have, like, some sort of, like, personality trait, or they lack a certain personality trait that makes them susceptible to falling into these sorts of groups.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe that makes me a horrible person.
I'd rather have that gap in my life filled by Game of Thrones and be disappointed than have to seek a cult.
Yeah. Anything else on Nexium?
No,
I'm good. Sounds like these people are going away, right?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So I wanted to talk about porn. I've talked to Alec about this before, and I'm interested to hear, I don't know if we've ever talked about it in depth, but I'm also interested to hear what Serby thinks. So the impetus of this is that on July 15th, there's an age verification law for porn that will go in effect in the UK. So this means that you can't just type in your date of birth on a porn site. You'll either have to type in your credit card, your passport, or go to a shop to get some sort of verification. And now this is just one example of many things in our culture that is happening that deems porn to be a really bad thing. I mean, I even hear this in conversations just with friends of mine. They say, I had to stop watching porn because it's just bad for your brain, I've heard. And although I'm not here to argue that porn is good necessarily, I do think this focus on the badness of porn is a little bit unfair, and I think the problem is much bigger, because my contention is that almost everything is porn. Media itself is porn. So the most, just to give you guys a piece of context about what I mean by this is, so when I think about my life and how my brain was quote unquote hurt by pornography, the most harmful piece of pornography I ever saw were teen comedies when I was a kid. and I'm not talking about it in any sexual way, but it idealized a reality that I believed in.
Right.
So I remember there was this one movie. This is actually relatively contemporary, but I watched a lot of those Freddie Prinze Jr. movies when I was in middle school and stuff like that. But I don't really remember the specifics of those. But I do remember that in 2010, there was this movie called, like, Friends with Benefits or something, with Justin Timberlake and Mila Kunis. And in this movie, both of them are effortlessly on top of their game career-wise, and they're so good-looking, and there's zero indication of any sacrifice that they had to do to get there. Only the complete entitlement that this luxurious lifestyle inherent in watching these people only bitch about the fact that they don't know if having regular hot sex is fulfilling enough for them. That's their only conflict. And I feel like things like the Disney Channel with their Hannah Montana and all that shit, it ritualizes things like having a boyfriend or a girlfriend in sixth grade, or having a certain waist size, or being able to afford a certain wardrobe, or when you should start thinking about sex, or what your conversations should sound like, what kind of topics they should aspire to be talking about. I just think that if your argument is that porn promotes a shallow misunderstanding of sex that can warp your understanding of it, I contend that all of media, especially scripted TV and movies, promote a devastatingly shallow misunderstanding of life. And I think that porn is being unfairly scapegoated, and that people are extremely narrow-minded in their condemnation of it, because it's a much bigger problem. There's a movie, a Joseph Gordon-Levitt movie called Don John, which I like a lot. I don't know if either of you guys have seen it. Joseph Gordon-Levitt starred in it and directed it. I don't know if he wrote it, but it's about a guy who's addicted to porn. And once again, that's a bad thing. I'm not saying that porn is great for you. But there's one scene that I felt was really, really smart. And it's a scene where he meets this woman, played by Scarlett Johansson, and she basically is super against porn. She says, if I ever catch you watching porn, you know, you're the shittiest person in the world. Porn is the worst thing in the world. Fuck you. But her thing is chick flicks. And one of the best scenes in the movie is that they go to a movie theater, and her watching the chick flick is dramatized using cinematography and cutting in the same way that the movie depicts Joseph Gordon-Levitt watching porn. The message being that just as Joseph Gordon-Levitt is engrossed by the ideal life of pornography, so too is Scarlett Johansson, quote-unquote, getting off on the ideal reality of rom-coms. And it's a really, really great scene. And I don't know, what do you guys think about this? Have you read things about pornography specifically that you think are particularly harmful, more so than any other media?
Well, I don't think this is about pornography. I think that it's an excuse to test privacy boundaries. Like, when I read this, what I thought was that what better way to set a precedent for a highly invasive process than to create a policy under the guise of protecting children from harmful content? So I wonder if this was just like, let's test the waters. Let's see how far we can get. And how can we exercise this legal expansion in the future?
Wow.
Yeah. So when I was reading about this law, I had seen essentially you'd have to put in a driver's license or some sort of, but essentially like, let's just say in the best of worlds, you're scanning your driver's license for whatever porn site and they've got it. And let's say they're not selling it to any, they're not like selling that identifying information to anyone. They're keeping it on lock, all that stuff. That's best case scenario. Then they get hacked and then everyone knows like exactly what you've been watching. That's a little fucked up. And then worst case scenario is like, now that they have your information, they can do targeted advertising based on the porn you watch and like all this other creepy shit. Now, to your point, Jared, I mostly agree with you in that like, yeah, everything is porn. Obviously, there's like our weird, we have like a cultural hangup about sex in general and the way like the certain ages we should hit as we're exposed to different kind of sexual things. And, you know, I don't even know what the age to watch porn is, like 18 or whatever. And I'm sure 95% of teenagers are ignoring those laws. I think one way to view it is like, well, everything is porn, so fuck it. And that's like kind of like a nihilist approach. And I'm not...
I'm not saying fuck it. I'm just saying we're focusing on the wrong thing.
Well, yeah. No, that's true. This law is bad and seems invasive and shitty. And I like Serby's take that it's a test case for more invasive shit. But the whole complaint about porn is that it sets like unreal expectations. Not even just unreal expectations. It sets like a fantasy land of like how sex works that is not how sex works, or how normal people are, also just like what people look like. But in the same way that porn stars have like all this cosmetic surgery and breast implants and these other things, like all these fucking celebrities we're watching in rom-coms or any other movie are like teaching people how to have eating disorders and all this other shit. And then, you know, to your point about the teen flicks or whatever, like, yeah, I had a similar experience where I had an idea of how reality was in my mind that was not at all true based on like the media I was consuming. I think that would, my argument would be like, all that stuff is bad. Not that I want to create a law against or anything. I don't really know how I'd interact if I had a kid. I just wouldn't I they wouldn't have a computer. We'd live in the woods and they would have access to nothing.
No, man, that's not the answer. I mean, I'm constantly going, I'm harping on the same shit all the time, but the problem is, so, you know, we always talk about representation, whether certain races, creeds, whatever, need to be more represented in media, or if we need to stop representing only hot people having sex, which is, I guess, an argument for porn, or if we shouldn't even represent people having sex on screen at all. For me, the problem is not about whether what we represent on screens. It's the fact that people are not aware of what representation is. Like, we need to be critical of what representation does. We're refusing to see the bigger problem, especially when it's so ingrained in society. So we can talk about Me Too, but we don't talk about alcohol. We can talk about representation in media, but we don't talk about the fact that the media is a giant desire factory, mm-hmm. and the necessity of representation is just a symptom of the fact that media is just constantly pumping out and telling us what to desire. That is the problem, and we're just fucking bickering about this other shit that isn't really focusing on that problem.
Yeah, but when you say media is a desire factory, I'm like, yeah, how can we get to the root of that problem?
I mean, look, as I've said, I've done a fair amount of growing just being able to recognize that and critically deduce that, oh, wow, yeah, all those fantasies I had after watching Freddie Prinze Jr. movies and thinking that this is how my life is going to be, that's dumb. You know, I shouldn't think that. I wish I was armed with the ability to understand that and to be critical of that when I watched those movies back then, but I wasn't.
Yeah, but I think at the same time, you could be aware of it. Let's say every image of a man I've ever seen is like this fucking swole dude, like on every TV show, whatever, and I'm like, oh God, I don't look like that. I'm a fat, disgusting mess. And I am a fat, disgusting mess, but that's fine. I'm fine with it. But like, even if I recognize that the media is pumping this into me, it is like very hard to uproot psychologically. And I think this is essentially what a lot of psychology shows, is that like a lot of different issues people, I'm just using the example of body image, but like, you know, I think in a more abstract sense, you could talk about rom-coms and shit like that. But like, just telling them that it's artificial does not necessarily make the problem go away because it's so deeply rooted. I don't know. What do you think?
No, I agree, but it can help.
Yeah.
I think that we'll see some changes in like the next like handful of years. Do either of you remember that Dove beauty commercial? Yeah. I think that it aired during the Super Bowl. Yeah. So I think that was like one step to show people that what you see is not real. And there's been quite a bit of research in recent years that researchers have done on adolescence and social media, and the idea that they form these unrealistic idealizations of body image and life, and that it all stems from seeing these highly curated feeds on Facebook and Instagram. And so there are like schools, I think, that are trying to develop these programs that combat these issues, to tell kids and try to instill these critical thinking skills and help them develop coping mechanisms that allow them to see that what you see is not real. So that when they watch a Freddie Prinze Jr. rom-com, they don't fall into that trap that like, this is how things should be, this is how I should be.
Yeah, I'd be interested to hear more about that, because I mean, I'm always talking about how we need to be much more educated, more responsible consumers. Not only should we be placing the complete burden of responsibility on the content makers or the people who are producing these images, but we also need to put responsibility on the consumers. So that school you're talking about sounds like a fucking godsend.
Yeah, that program sounds awesome.
Yeah, and I think there's like in psychology as well, like a lot of therapists have seen a rise in adolescents coming to them feeling this burden that they're not living up to these societal expectations and these unrealistic representations of beauty or success. And so I think this is something that's being discussed, like how can we educate people, how, like what can we do, how can we be proactive. So I'll do more research and I will share.
Thank you.
All right, guys, we're running a little low on time, so we're going to skip right to Serby's last thing she brought in, Marie Kondo. So Old Town Road, platform gaming, and the Smart Jewel, we will try to cover next week. So Serby, what you got?
Let's talk about Marie Kondo. This woman's very existence gives me so much anxiety. So Marie Kondo developed this decluttering method. It's called the KonMari method, and this is from her website. you keep only those things that speak to the heart and discard items that no longer spark joy. Thank them for their service, then let them go. So this tidying up method has become a craze, and she has a Netflix show. She's all over TV, all over the internet, and people either feel like her decluttering method is revolutionary and relaxing, and then other people like me find it infuriating. And researchers have studied decluttering, and some believe that decluttering can make you happy because when you discard items, it can release dopamine, which is a pleasure hormone. While other researchers believe that throwing away an item that means something to you activates the part of the brain that processes pain. So I am a bit of a hoarder, and I think that it's absurd that they that she has this joy factor measurement. I think it's inane. And like, there are a lot of things that don't spark joy, but I need them, like toilet paper. It doesn't spark joy unless I'm like, I just came from my grandmother's house and had a shit ton of Indian food, in which case I'm like, hell yeah, my 25 pack of Costco toilet paper is here. But it serves a significant purpose in my life, so it stays. And I think that like Marie Kondo came on the scene like at a perfect moment. Like, she's very on trend right now. Like, everybody wants a Pinterest-worthy home where everything is white and bright and clean and fits in a perfectly sized container. And I don't know. I just, for me, like, I roll my eyes whenever I see Marie Kondo on a screen.
So I've seen her show. I also have some friends who are really into the book. And I both love and hate her. I mean, her as a person, whatever. But, like, the method, because I live in New York City in a one-bedroom apartment. So I have, like, literally a finite amount of space. So, you know, I think it's a useful exercise to put all your clothes in a pile and be like, all right, what do I actually wear? Like, I don't really do the spark joy thing, but I'm like, I do think about it. Like, this shirt that I wore 5 years ago, like, do I really need it? Does it spark joy? And then I throw it out and I feel better about myself. Great. I didn't realize this. This is in her book. I haven't seen this in her, or maybe it's in her show, but her approach to books I find horrifying and appalling. Whoever's listening to this can't see this, but I have color-coded bookshelves behind me right now. Essentially, you're supposed to do it with your books. Like, if your books don't spark joy, like if your old copy of War and Peace isn't sparking joy, throw it out. Or even then, I think you're supposed to cut out like the favorite passages you have and keep those and then get rid of the rest. Absolutely fucking not. First of all, for so many people, did you not know this, Jared?
Wait, you're telling me you're supposed to deface your books?
Yes.
But how, that doesn't even give you any more space. It doesn't make anything
cleaner. Because
if
you like have a binder full of your favorite passages of, you know, Tolstoy or something, you can go back and it's like, oh, I love these three pages. And first of all, for like professional reasons, like I could never do it. Like, so many times I haven't even thought about a book in a decade, like when I read it in college. And I'm like, wait, Jared, let me just wander over to my bookshelf and see if I have it. And I do, my underlining is still there and it's still extremely useful. Yeah, and there's just like other reasons to have a book. Like, I love giving my friends or lending my friends books, sometimes giving them books and like sort of sharing them the things that I've read that I've enjoyed that still spark joy to me. I think they're often when people are looking at your bookshelf, it's a conversation starter. If you have friends over for dinner, I know it sounds really tacky. And then if they're color coded, they literally look good. So, I mean, they look good otherwise too. So I hate that part of it. And also I think there's a weird thing with, I read this interesting article and I can't remember where it was, but minimalism you would think is something that like anyone could do, because obviously having a few amount of things is something, even if you're rich or poor, you could do. But actually that's not the case, because to live minimalistly, you have to be in a position where you can throw shit out and then buy it again if you need it again. Whereas like, I'm a person who grew up without a lot of money. So I, even though like I am not poor now, I still am in the mindset of like, oh shit, like, you know, I either gained or lost weight and these jeans don't fit anymore. I better hold on to them for 10 years in case I'm ever that weight again, because I can't buy another. And in reality, I can buy another pair of pants, but that's how I still think. But like, for people who don't have that money, that they literally need to think like that, or, you know, like a tool that they bought or something like that. Like, what if they need that tool in the future? So yeah, it's infuriating in a lot of ways.
This sounds to me like another it's just another part of this craze of only positive thinking.
Yeah.
Because isn't it just, she's just like, all right, anything that brings you down, just purge it from your life.
I mean, I think she probably says that necessities like toilet paper are fine. And, you know, in her show, I've seen her, like, obviously she's organizing people's kitchens and it's not like their forks bring them joy, but they need them. But yeah, I think it is this cult, sort of like cult of positivity. I also think it's kind of, it's almost like the gamification thing, like this, like you have to make your personal life as efficient as possible. And the sort of clutter in your life makes your life inefficient. Therefore it's bad. Whereas, yeah, I think that's not a great way to look at life. Yeah.
I pretty much discredited me doing the Marie Kondo thing as soon as, like, okay, if it sparks joy, throw it out. I mean, I'd throw out my whole fucking house.
Nothing
sparks
joy.
You know what
I'm
saying? Nothing sparks joy.
Woody sparks joy.
Well, I wouldn't throw him out. I mean, that's he would be the only thing that stays.
I will say, though, she has a way of folding clothes, and I'm sure other people have done it too. It's amazing. I recommend that to everyone. Do your drawers like Marie Kondo does. You put the shirts vertically. It makes everything easier to find. Thank you, Marie Kondo.
All right. All right, guys. Well, that's it for our second attempt at Culture Binge. Once again, this has been the May 22nd version of Culture Binge. I want to thank our awesome crew. Thank you, Alec. And thank you, Serby. It's been really great having you. And so this is probably going to go up on our Wise Cast channel. As soon as we figure out how to do, because we were supposed to do this live, as soon as we figure out how to do it with all of our cameras on, we're probably going to start live streaming this on Wisecrack, and then we'll probably create its own RSS feed. But in the meantime, if you guys are listening to this and you enjoy it, please leave us a comment on the Wisecast channel or send us an email. You can hit us up at info@wisecrack.co, or you can hit our movie podcast, Show Me the Meaning, inbox at movies@wisecrack.co, or leave us a voicemail at 21ElfGut07. So 213-534-8807. So leave us a voicemail on that. And yeah, we're excited to keep on doing this. And yeah, that's about it from us. Anything else you guys want to say to the people before we sign off?
Thanks for listening.
Thanks. Extra thanks to our patrons, because they're awesome. And
yes,
I don't think this episode, but there's a lot of discussion in our patron Discord, which I think will inform this podcast, because it's how I keep up with what's popular.
Yeah, they're very good at alerting us when something significant is happening. All right, guys. Peace.